Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel, Jill Robbins, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
Gabriel Boric won Chile's presidential election on Sunday. He defeated José Antonio Kast in a second election after the first round of voting in November did not produce a winner. The two men received the most votes in November. Boric, 35, will be Chile's youngest modern president when he takes office in March. He entered politics in 2014 when he won a congressional election. Boric was known then for leading protests demanding improvements in the educational system. During the campaign, he promised to move the South American country away from some economic policies put in place during the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. Pinochet was in power from 1973 to 1990. Kast praised some policies of the Pinochet time during the campaign. Boric finished the first vote 2 points behind Kast, but he gained voters outside of the capital of Santiago before the second election. He finished ahead of Kast by 20 points in the northern region of Antofagasta. He won by 10 points overall. Boric said he would raise taxes on rich people to fund social programs, help the environment, and fight inequality in Chile. Kast, 55, won less than 8% of the vote in 2017. He gained popularity in the last 4 years with policy arguments compared to those of former United States President Donald Trump. Kast said he would restrict migration from countries like Haiti and Venezuela. There are fears in Chile that migrants are responsible for an increase in crime. As the election got closer, both candidates tried to move toward the middle to capture more voters. Boric was supported by Chile's left-wing parties, including the Communist Party. After adding new advisors in recent weeks, Boric said any changes would happen slowly and responsibly. Before the vote, a political expert at the University of Chile said people in the country were not excited about either candidate. Robert Funk said people in Chile worried that Kast would put extreme policies in place and that Boric was inexperienced. Even with the win, Boric may not be able to have a major effect on Chile because the Congress is divided. In addition, the Constitution of Chile is in the process of being rewritten for the first time since the time of Pinochet. There could be a new election in the near future. I'm Dan Friedel.
Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai has denied saying she was sexually assaulted. In November, a message appeared on her social media account saying that a former top Chinese Communist Party official had forced her into sex. Recently, the Lianhe Zaobao Chinese language newspaper published a video of Peng. The publication said the video was taken Sunday in Shanghai. In the video, Peng said she had been staying at home in Beijing, but was free to come and go as she chose. Peng told the newspaper, "First of all, I want to emphasize something that is very important. I have never said that I wrote that anyone sexually assaulted me. I need to emphasize this point very clearly." The reporter did not ask how or why the long and detailed message appeared on November 2nd. The reporter also did not ask whether another person used Peng's account without her approval. The newspaper said it talked with Peng at an event for the Beijing Winter Olympic Games. The games begin on February 4th. The video shows her standing outside a ski competition in Shanghai. Peng dropped out of public view after she accused 75-year-old Zhang Gaoli of sexual wrongdoing. He is a former vice premier and member of the party's powerful Politburo Standing Committee. The social media message with the accusation was quickly removed from Weibo, a Chinese social media service. But images of the accusation quickly spread across China's internet. Supporters are concerned about Peng's safety. The Women's Tennis Association, or WTA, announced it was canceling all events in China. Following the release of the message, the three-time Olympian and former Wimbledon champion appeared at a tennis event in Beijing. She was seen waving and writing her name on tennis balls for children. The foreign arm of Chinese state TV also issued a statement in English, which it said was from Peng. That statement denied Peng's accusation against Zhang. However, WTA head Steve Simon questioned whether the emailed statement came from Peng. Others said it only increased their concern about her safety. In the Lianhe Zaobao, Peng said she wrote the statement in Chinese, and it was later turned into English. She said that there was no major difference in meaning between the two versions. Zhang was a top official working with President and party leader Xi Jinping. He has not appeared in public or commented on Peng's accusation. Simon said the WTA board of directors, players, and financial backers supported the move to stop the women's tennis competitions in China. It was the strongest public stand against China taken by a sports body, and one that could cost the WTA millions of dollars. Simon has made repeated calls for China to carry out an investigation into the 35-year-old Peng's accusations. The WTA wants to speak directly with the former number one ranked doubles player. The International Olympic Committee has dealt with the matter in a different way. Its top officials say they believe Peng is fine after a video call with her. I'm Jill Robbins.
The Reuters news agency recently examined a group of new studies on COVID-19. These studies, for the most part, have yet to be closely examined by outside experts. They include information that needs further study to support their findings. Researchers said last week that differences in how well Omicron and other variants of the coronavirus multiply may help predict Omicron's effects. Compared to the earlier Delta variant, Omicron multiplies itself 70 times more quickly in tissues that line airway passages. This may speed up person-to-person spread, the researchers said. But in lung tissues, Omicron multiplies 10 times more slowly than the original kind of the coronavirus. This difference might lead to less severe illness. An official report of these findings is under careful study by a group of experts before publication and has not been released by the research team. In a news release issued by Hong Kong University, study leader Dr. Michael Chen Chi-Wai said, "It is important to note that the severity of disease in humans is not determined only by virus replication, but also by each person's immune response to the infection. Such a response sometimes turns into life-threatening inflammation." Chan added, "By infecting many more people, a very infectious virus may cause more severe disease and death, even though the virus itself may be less pathogenic." Pathogenic is a term that describes something such as a type of bacteria or a virus that causes disease. Chan explained further, "Taken together with our recent studies showing that the Omicron variant can partially escape immunity from vaccines and past infection, the overall threat from Omicron variant is likely to be very significant." Another group of researchers said a model of how the Omicron variant attaches to cells and antibodies gives information about its behavior and will help in designing treatments. Using computer models of the spike protein on Omicron's surface, they examined changes occurring when the spike grabs onto a cell surface protein called ACE2, the virus's way into the cell. The research team also modeled the spike with different classes of antibodies trying to attack it. The antibodies attack from different places, like a football team's defense might tackle a ball carrier, said Joseph Lubin of Rutgers University in New Jersey. The findings, posted last week on the website BioArchive ahead of examination by outside experts, need to be checked, particularly with real-world samples from people, Lubin said. He added, "While our molecular structure predictions are by no means a final word on Omicron, we hope they enable a faster and more effective response from the global community." A third study, put online last week in the publication JAMA Network Open, showed that infected people who show no symptoms might be helping to spread SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. Such cases, known as asymptomatic cases, could make up to 40.5% of confirmed infections worldwide. Researchers grouped data from 77 earlier studies involving a total of 19,884 individuals with confirmed SARS-CoV-2 infections. They found that among infected people in the general community, about 40% were asymptomatic, as were 54% of infected pregnant women, 53% of infected air or cruise travelers, 48% of infected nursing home residents or staff, and 30% of infected healthcare workers or hospitalized patients. The grouped percentage of asymptomatic infections was about 46% in North America, 44% in Europe, and 28% in Asia. Min Liu and other researchers at Peking University in China wrote, "The high percentage of asymptomatic infections highlights the possible spread risk of asymptomatic infections in communities." The researchers added that officials should check for asymptomatic infections, and those who are identified should be under management similar to that for confirmed infections, including isolating and contact tracing. I'm John Russell.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President James Garfield was shot and seriously wounded in the summer of 1881. The man who shot him said he supported the political group that supported Vice President Chester Arthur. The gunman was found to be insane. But some people were ready to believe the worst about Vice President Arthur. They knew that many of the Vice President's political allies disliked President Garfield. They thought the Vice President might have helped the gunman in some way. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell what happened after President Garfield was shot.
For a time, it seemed the president might get better. But the bullet wound became infected. He died of the infection 2 months after he was shot. Vice President Arthur took the oath of office a few hours after the president's death. Chester Arthur had been a successful lawyer. He had worked in politics for a number of years, but he had never before held an elected office. Many Americans questioned his ability to serve in the White House. One person put it this way: "Chet Arthur, President of the United States? Good God!"
Almost everyone feared Arthur would be a tool of a Republican Party leader in New York, Roscoe Conkling. They were sure Conkling would be the real power in Arthur's administration. They were wrong. Chester Arthur surprised everyone. He broke all his ties with the Conkling political machine. He remained independent of any party group. Arthur asked Garfield's cabinet to resign. He chose new men for all but one department.
In his first message to Congress, President Arthur asked for changes in the way government jobs were filled. He proposed a new civil service system that would let ability, not politics, decide who got government jobs. Republican Party leaders opposed these proposals. The civil service system, would stop them from giving federal jobs to their supporters. It would destroy much of their power. These Republican leaders controlled Congress. They refused to act on the civil service proposals.
Civil service reform, however, was an important issue. President Garfield had been assassinated by a man who believed he should have gotten a government job because of his politics. Also, new cases of dishonesty had been discovered in the Post Office Department. The public began to demand laws to clean up the civil service. In 1882, a new Congress was elected. The new Congress was controlled by the Democratic Party. President Arthur again appealed for civil service reform. This time, he got results. The new Congress passed a civil service bill that required 10% of all federal jobs to be filled through competitive examinations. This 10% included half the officials in the Post Office Department. It included most workers at federal customs houses. The bill also said it was illegal for politicians to ask government employees for campaign money, and it set up a civil service committee to enforce the new law.
President Arthur also found himself faced with an unusual problem. The government was earning more money than it needed. Most of the money came from tariffs, taxes on imports. Each year, tariffs brought in $100 million more than the government needed. The import taxes had been set high to protect American industries from foreign competition. President Arthur wanted to reduce the tariffs. Congress wanted to keep them high. Industrial leaders wanted to keep them high, too. They did not want to compete with low-priced foreign products.
Congress saw no problem with the extra money brought in by high tariffs. It found many ways to spend it. For example, Congress raised payments to soldiers who had fought in the Civil War during the 1860s. It also approved money to build roads, bridges, and waterways throughout the country. Many of these things were not needed. They were approved for political purposes. They put government money into the home areas of powerful congressmen. In 1882, Congress passed the Rivers and Harbors Bill. The bill would cost almost $19 million. President Arthur vetoed the bill. He said it would waste too much money, but Congress passed the bill into law over his veto.
Next, President Arthur urged Congress to form a committee to find a way to reduce tariffs. Congress formed the committee. The committee proposed that tariffs be reduced by 20%. But Congress did not consider the proposal when it began debating a new tariff bill. President Arthur was more successful in getting Congress to reduce the public debt. During his term, the debt was cut by more than $400 million.
Chester Arthur's efforts for honest government and lower taxes won him much support among the people. But he could not win the support of his Republican Party. Arthur wanted to serve another 4 years in the White House. His name was put before the Republican nominating convention in 1884. The name of Senator James Blaine of Maine also was put before the convention. On the first ballot, Blaine received 334 votes. Arthur got only 278. 3 ballots later, Blaine won the presidential nomination. However, many Republicans refused to support Blaine. They accused him of being dishonest. They said he was controlled by powerful politicians.
The Democratic Party chose New York Governor Grover Cleveland as its presidential candidate. Like Chester Arthur at the national level, Grover Cleveland was known for fighting dishonesty in government at the local level. He began as mayor of the city of Buffalo, New York. He cleaned up the city government and saved the taxpayers much money. Next, he was elected governor of New York State. There, too, he helped end dishonesty in government. Cleveland refused to give jobs to Democrats because of their political ties. Instead, he filled state jobs with men of ability. This early success helped him win the Democratic presidential nomination.
The campaign of 1884 between Republican Blaine and Democrat Cleveland was one of the most bitter in American political history. A group of Republicans who opposed Blaine published letters to prove he was dishonest. Blaine had written the letters several years earlier during a shameful incident concerning the sale of railroad stock. Now he was forced to defend himself against those old charges.
Blaine's supporters fought back by discovering a scandal in Cleveland's past. Grover Cleveland had never married, but more than 10 years earlier, he had been involved with a young woman. The woman gave birth to a boy. Cleveland was not sure the boy was his son, but he accepted responsibility for the child. He sent money to help care for him. A Republican newspaper published the story. Soon, Republican crowds were shouting a joke about it. "Ma, Ma, where's my pa?" "Gone to the White House. Ha, ha, ha."
Both candidates campaigned hard. It was clear to everyone that the vote would be close. Election day was cold and rainy. Early results showed the two candidates with almost the same number of electoral votes. The winner would be the one who captured a majority of the popular votes in New York State. That candidate would then get all of New York's electoral votes. It was not until 3 days after the voting that election officials announced Cleveland had won. His victory set off wild celebrations among Democrats across the country. Grover Cleveland really was going to the White House. Ha, ha, ha. His election would bring some important changes to the country.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.